It's time to get real with Robin. Join veteran broadcaster Robin Côté and her co-hosts, known as The Collective, as they delve into subject matters that most are afraid to talk about, but need to hear. And now, get ready to get real.
Yeah, let's get real. I say the following statement with absolutely no political agenda or motivation, but solely as a sex crimes expert, living in a bubble can harm our children. Within each of us is a capacity to question what we hear and read, but also, and more importantly, to question our own beliefs. Sadly, many of us live in bubbles, only wanting to listen to those opinions and beliefs that mirror our own. To live outside the bubble takes kind of a courage, a willingness to change our beliefs based on new and countering information. So, just for a moment, forget if you're liberal or conservative. Forget if you voted red or blue. Forget about your stance on political issues like immigration. Instead, open your mind and listen to some facts for the sake of our children. Last week, there was a 533% increase in arrests of just registered sex offenders alone. Sexual predators who were caught illegally entering our country from Mexico. These sexual predators who would have been a real threat to everyone, but especially to the most vulnerable of our society, our children. Because within the ranks of those arrested sexual predators were child molesters. Now, thankfully, those predators were caught. But based on the sheer volume of those who have successfully made it across the border, who weren't detained and identified, could there be a percentage of registered sex offenders among them? Of course, the answer is yes. We will never know how many, but we would be living in complete ignorance if we assume none. And for the sake of our children, we have to be concerned about any and all child molesters coming into our country, regardless of our current belief about immigration. That is just one example of how we need to think of our children first before we think of some political talking point like immigration. Now, on the other side of the immigration issue, when a woman who is here illegally is raped, we must make her feel safe to report the crime. We have to provide her a safe haven from deportation so she can talk openly, willingly to the police. And in turn, we as a society will be able to learn about that crime and apprehend the predator. Again, keeping our society safe is primary. It's not about left and right. It's about doing what is right. Did I burst your bubble? Let's get real.
Wow, Darren. That just gave me chills hearing you read that.
Well, it's kind of cold in here.
Well, no. This is Get Real. And today we're kind of doing something a little different here. Darren read the intro. And Darren, you're supposed to introduce who our other co-host here.
I'm going to let you do that because it's your gig. It is, seriously.
No, it's our gig. Well, Darren Birch and myself are graced today with the wonderful Dr. Lisa Stroman. And I don't even have the information on this lady's bio because I was relying on Darren to do that. But
see how I am.
Yeah.
But, you know, I got to tell you something. I have been stalking Lisa since she was on Badge Boys, and I am so damn impressed. I watched her TED Talk, and she is one who goes out of her way to protect children. And Lisa, I can't say enough. I got the opportunity to sit here and talk with her before the show started. And we do things in our lifetime because of things that happen to us. And, you know, I feel bad that I'm not talking about your bio. I should have brought that up. See?
Plenty of information online. Right. People can just...
And there is a lot.
there is a lot. But you have such amazing biography of the things that you have done and gone out of your way to protect children. But as with always on this show, we do get real, and I like to peel back the layers. And on Badge Boys, she didn't reveal too much about why she has such a passion working in the field of helping children. So as I sit here and look at her, I am very honored that she's willing to share part of the background as to why she has this passion of going out there and teaching parents how to protect children, especially with the internet crimes. And opening our eyes to the things that are out there that are pretty damn scary that we don't even see because we choose to ignore it. As you said before in the intro, Darren, we ignore a lot of things. We guilt and we shame people. We don't allow them to talk openly about stuff. But Lisa has a backstory as to why she really digs down deep, and she has this huge passion to protect our children and to educate parents on how we can do things to look into protecting our children and just being good parents, pretty much. So if you don't mind, Lisa, I kind of want to talk a little bit about your background and what happened to you, because a lot of this centers around childhood trauma for you and why you've gone above and beyond to make sure our children today are protected from their traumas.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we were graced with some time before the show, and Darren brings up a good point of all these new predators that are coming in and the fact that we're bringing in all of these strangers that are coming in. But it would be remiss not to, as a psychologist, to acknowledge that a predominant amount of child abuse happens in the home. And I unfortunately grew up with a brother that was older, 18 months older than I was, and so for 7 years endured child abuse through the hands of my own brother, and had to deal with the fact that parents didn't believe me, the signs weren't seen. Like, what do we do in those situations where it isn't always strangers? Not only do we as parents now have to worry about, you know, whether it's a neighbor or a coach or somebody that we're putting our children with, but we also have to think about what's happening in our own homes and what's normalized and what's not normalized. And mine was pretty traumatic. I mean, it wasn't a consent situation. There was chronic strangulation and, like, you know, just a lot of threats of death. I've been stabbed by him multiple times with pencils and, you know, like, multiple things that had happened that just was like a fear-based situation. And I remember thinking, like, that I wasn't going to let this person beat me. And so that probably who I am today and the resilience that I have and why I went through all this schooling and I did all of these things was because I was like, I'm not going to let somebody hold me down. And so I never apologize for my story. I never want somebody to feel sorry for my story. I never want people to look at me and say, oh my goodness, how terrible that was. This was my fuel. This was my energy. And of course it's trauma, right? So I had to, like, work through that. And it's probably why I went to school for so long. but it is something that I feel like if I can get through it, other people can get through it, but kids certainly can't get through it alone. And you have to have someone there to talk to you and deal with that and manage that with yourself.
And you also talked about off air beforehand that you grew up in a house where you were witnessing something very tumultuous going on between your parents as well. Not just having to deal with the molestation by your own brother and being attacked and having him choke you out all the time, but the fact that you were seeing your parents emulate this same type of behavior.
Yeah, my first memory really was like my dad and my mom. I was five and I walked out and I heard screaming and my dad was pulling my mom down the hallway and they were arguing about something and I was told to get back in my room with tons of expletives. And then I, like, remember sneaking back out when I heard quiet and found them in the front room and my mom, who's about my size, like 5'6" and little, you know, and my dad, who is 6'3" and about 250, 270 probably at the time. She just knocked him out and he went to the ground and she ran out the front door and I ended up, like, going out my window and crawling to the neighbors all bloodied through the thistles and all of that. And the neighbor happened to be a child psychologist. And I remember in the morning I woke up and at five asked how to spell divorce and knew, you know, my life would change at that moment. And really went through years and years of alcoholism and drug abuse and all of these things that my parents, you know, kind of went through on their own and watched from a distance and was graced by my grandmother who moved in, lived with us on and off for 12 years. And that's where I tell parents, like, you need one person, you know, and if you're not the person, find the person. Right. And I don't know if it was intentional by my father that he knew, you know, because of his travel and his work and all of the things that he did. But he had that person with me and I had that advocate and I had that person who was like, you're stronger than this. Like, you can do this. And I, you know, by the grace of God, she was in my life.
You know, when you're on Badge Boys and you had brought up your closeness with your grandmother, and I remember it vividly because as a detective, I was thinking there's a story there. But you, as a expert coming on a show, I didn't want to press because you don't know how somebody's going to feel about that. So that's why it's wonderful that you and Robin were going to have those minutes. And you said before the show, things happen for a reason. Mm-hmm. I was running late. You two were able to kind of bond. And that's so important to share a story, but not everybody can. Mm-hmm. I want to just throw out a few stats, and I hate stats, but just so we can understand, 1 in 5 girls are victims of child sexual abuse. 1 in 5. So when you kind of shared this is something that hits close to you, it didn't surprise me, sadly.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the part that I think that you, as a parent, if you're not paying attention to that and you're not looking for the signs, I would suggest that it's much higher now, given the fact that our children are online and we don't know those reporting stats because kids aren't talking about it, because it's shame and it's fear and it's, sadly, their fear of getting the devices that are giving them access to be abused getting taken away from them.
You know, when I said I was going to introduce a stat, even though I hate stats, and you're spot on, because you don't know an unknown. And the best way I can describe why I think the numbers are grossly low is because my very first week as a child crime supervisor, having came from homicide and rapes and different details, I've seen a lot of busy activity. When it gets dark at night, a lot of times the ugliness comes out. And my very first week taking over for that child crime squad, when I was on standby, we worked that Monday. And then at 5 p.m. Monday, my squad's on call out, if you will, for the entire week into the following, if you will, Monday morning. I never went home. I never went home. Yeah. It was one call after another. And I'm not exaggerating. And for cops out there, they're like, well, you're exaggerating. No, I literally ran home, grabbed, knowing this was going to be a horrific, horrific detail in terms of call-ins. And like Lisa said, they don't report initially. It's delayed reporting in the sense that with a homicide, we have a dead body, we have a scene. With a rape, many times, not most, but many times, adult women will report. And so we have a scene, you know, especially with a stranger danger, not so much with the knowns.
Well, even in my case, when I was 17 and went home and told my parents I was raped, my father refused to call the police and my mother did nothing. So there are so many that do go unreported unless there's something more drastic that happens.
And with us going to a non-scene, we're going to, is based on, like Lisa was saying, some advocate in their life that's not necessarily a, you know, quote-unquote advocate, but someone who, you know, is that guardian, if you will, in the sense of helping this child, whether it be a teacher. And of course, now with schools, you know, off again, a lot of abuse has been going unnoticed. School resource officers, many times school resource officers pick it up in schools. It's so many of these crimes are based on a child finally finding someone they trust enough to share something that is devastating their world. And I have all these stats that talk about young ladies who have this type of abuse, their relationships suffer, you know, romantically, sexually, intimately, they get involved with drugs, of course, sadly, suicide. You are truly a testament to survival and resiliency. And I thank you so much, Lisa, for everything you're doing in this world. Thank you.
Of course. I think, you know, it'd be interesting, like, to mention here that when you're an officer and you report to a scene or you're getting called, you know something has happened in that situation. I worked in a family reunification program, no business, at the age of 18, but I thought this is where I kind of started that piece of, like, how do I help? And these women, children had been taken into this system, and the moms and the children had been separated so that the kids could actually be spoken to by officers that were brought in through that system. And what I noticed in that, as a young person, again, didn't have the training. I was just starting college. But I remember that the predominant issue was that those kids wanted to go back. It didn't matter the abuse that was happening. So a lot of times the kids were like, I don't care that I'm expected to do or give oral sex in order to get my deodorant. I don't care that I have to come in and be abused at night. I just want to be back with my home, my mom. I want to be back in that, because they don't know the unknown. And so I think that there's a lot of victimless crimes where kids, to your point, like, you might be shamed by a family member or it might be ignored, but it's also like sometimes those victims themselves are like, it's better just to endure it than to tear apart what I know is my system.
The devil, you know.
Yeah. And the guilt portrayed by the predator, the grooming process in which that uncle, brother, father, mother, not just grooming that child first through various acts and so forth. You know, when I say grooming, for those who don't understand what I'm talking about, it's minimizing the shame, if you will, of the act, so that the child will engage with them, showing pictures, alcohol, whatever it may be. But one of the grooming techniques is the guilt, telling that child that this is our secret. If you share this, it will destroy the family. I will go to jail. You will have destroyed our family. And putting that on, you know, a five-year-old little girl.
Yeah, or being threatened.
Yeah, or physically threatened. I mean, the gamut is so much. And to think that one out of five women have been abused as a child just destroys me. And yet, when I took over that squad, I really realized very quickly that is real, and it's more than real, because like we've all talked about, many of these crimes go unreported, and most of them, I mean, the lion's share, 95%, are reported late. The other thing I want to kind of bring in, and we could work around it or not, is the idea that these folks that are coming through the border that were registered sex offenders, they're not going to just show up in a park. They have some type of conduit. They are somebody's brother, somebody's father, somebody's neighbor, somebody's gardener, because we went away from the whole stranger danger as cops in the 60s, 70s, stranger danger. And even though one in four cases are stranger dangers, they do occur. They're usually reported. And that's the huge difference, other than the fact there's a different grooming mechanism, and usually there isn't. But on the stranger danger, it's not a grooming mechanism. But when we're talking about that person in your life, we used to say, you know, a trusted family member and so forth. But it can be the person that you always meet at the pool or the playground. You know, it can be that neighbor's best friend that your parents may not even know about. And you as parents out there, I'm telling you, if there's that person somehow, not necessarily a trusted family member, but it can be, most certainly can be, if there's that person who just always wants to be around your kids and forsakes a life of their own just so they can be with your kids, don't ever think, well, that's so brazen, they couldn't be doing it. They are so brazen because it consumes them. It consumes their every waking second. I haven't been told that by countless child molesters who I've caught. They when I talk with them, and I hate to call it an interrogation because it kind of gives a mindset of, you know, the light and the ruler on the knuckles. It's really an interview, and I kind of put myself in their place and say, why? You know, as a human being, I can't understand this, and I can't. I don't have that sexual motivation. They do, and it's a lot stronger than you and I. It truly consumes her every waking second. The very first case I ever had, and I may have shared this, and I have, please stop me and we'll move to a different topic. But it was a father who worked for, I'll say it, Honeywell. He was an engineer, you know, very intelligent man. And he just walked into precinct as I was a young troop. So over 30 years, it hasn't just been child crimes detail. Patrol officers run across this. SROs run across this. But the guy just walked into the police station and wanted to turn himself in. A crime had not even been reported. And this young cop in the late 80s had no time, no experience, kind of like what you're talking about at 18, and, you know, had no idea how to interview this guy. I just let him talk. But at the end, I had to ask, you seem like a nice guy. You seem like somebody I would trust with my kids. And you molested your son, and you're sitting here crying. Why'd you do it? And he said, it consumes my every waking second when I go to work, when I go to play, when I go to shower, when I go to theater, when I go to movies, when I go to visit friends. Every single second, it's on my mind.
You know, when I was in law school, there was a case, Kansas v. Hendricks, and I will never forget this because he stepped forward as an offender, and he's like, if you let me out, I will do this again. And they're like, we're going to give you programming, and we're going to do all these things, and we're going to get you. And they let him out, and he did it again. And then they put him through all these programs, and he actually said that these were the things that he was going to do, and he did it again. And it was so frustrating to read through that and I wanted to go into policy, and I was like, we've got to figure this out. Do you know what our country today, if you commit a crime, a white collar crime, you're going to go to jail for longer periods than you are going to if you hurt a child.
That's
it
wrong.
It is insane the amount of policy change that has to happen if we're really going to get, and again, like, I'm not saying that putting a law on the books is going to stop these guys, to your point. Like, it's part of who they are. But if we don't recognize the fact that this is this internal drive, it is something that they really can't stop. And I think Leroy Hendricks was, I think his name was Leroy, like, he was the guy who I remember reading through his case and thinking, he knows that he can't stop himself. And I think that we've, from years and years of research, understand that we need to do something different because we're not stopping it. And we're not recognizing the signs, and we're not intervening early enough, and we're not talking about it.
Intervention. I love the fact that you said, you know, intervening enough. And I've been very fortunate a few occasions to have arrested a child molester early in their life. And I say that because I'm able to instill upon them, as, you know, at first I would talk about the shark, you know, that first taste of blood. And then from that on, you know, they're always going to go. But it's stronger than that. It's literally stronger than that. At least a shark is based on the food supply. And there's other aspects. These predators, like a shark, but worse, it consumes them to such a frenzied. And when I would talk with these young kids, I would kind of explain to them, and I say kids, I'm a grandpa, so everyone under 50 is a kid. I would explain to them that it's kind of like a car going down a bumpy road, and you want to get off on another path. And the more you take that new path, the more you create this road, and more that car is going to go down that road. And stay on the bumpy path. Don't go down that road of perversion. There was one young man who, as a young man, he found the enjoyment, sexual gratification. Again, it's like Pavlov's dog. And here I'm telling a doctor what.
It's okay. Good description.
You know, he would find himself mounting himself anally on a bedpost. And he found gratification from that. But it got to the point of being violent, and then he would read porn, and it was violent porn. And now he's Pavlov's dog. He's giving himself this gratification based on this reward mechanism of something violent. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I think that I've spoken, I should probably do more on it, but like this generation of developing pedophilia, because what we see is that we've got kids that are watching and looking at their first porn by the age of 8 now, and
because
chronic
of the internet. Sure.
Because of the internet, and because they have access. It's probably actually earlier now, just because of COVID and the fact that we just immersed kindergarten up without any kind of device training or any of that stuff. But it's been typically around 8 years old, first exposure. Chronic viewing begins at 11. So if you think about the sexualization of young boys and their age, so if it's at between 8 and 11, you're starting to attach your sexual fantasies at these really early ages. And what you see is that it progresses. So it's no longer just kind of that normal porn that like kind of pops in your box. They have to start searching out more and more extreme porn and more cases. But the point of the introduction of that sexualization at that really young age typically can, just like any sort of like fetish that occurs where people have fetish on feet because they are masturbating and looking, you know, under the doors, or like, you know, they're in a lot of times, like, nobody talks about the rubber fetish, but like boys are like hiding in their garages and they're masturbating in their garages because they don't want their parents to find them. And so the smell of like cars and like tires, and anyway, it's just super fascinating terms of like how these things develop. But when you think about the psychology of it, you've got these young kids now that are being exposed to pornography at that age. So they're attaching that sexual attraction to these young girls. I'm seeing a huge amount of cases where I've got 20, 25, 30 year olds that are now like going into elementary school ages and being attracted to that age, because that's when their exposure to the sexualization started. So I think we're going to see this problem get much worse. And that's where, if we're not talking to our parents, if we're not talking to the people that are accessing kids and are in a protective fashion, and just looking for the signs and looking for the fact that you're actually isolating, or you see kids that are kind of withdrawing or habits are changing, like those things that we really have to look at and say, okay, what's going on here? without shame, without judgment, without making them feel like, oh my God, if you don't tell, this person's going to go. That's the piece that pisses me off, is that you tell these kids they're responsible for a generation of 10 years of like future predator because you didn't speak up. Like, that's not what a victim needs to hear. We don't need to tell them that it's their fault. I mean,
re-victimization.
Yeah, it's re-victimization, like over and over again. Yeah. So I think that you really have to understand the psychology of your victim. You have to understand the psychology of the predator, like you're speaking to, because it is pretty fascinating to me that they don't a lot of times understand or know why.
I every time you talk, it rings a bell of a case I had, because we've talked about violent predators. We've talked about stranger dangers. You know, we've talked about these different aspects. I had a case that was so problematic. And it was always these knowns, these, you know, somebody would report, some caring neighbor, some caring teacher, some caring individual. But when the child wouldn't make a disclosure, you know, many times the case is predicated on the disclosure of the child, unless you have some type of evidence, you know, that's culpatory in nature.
All these cop terms.
Yeah, right. That shows that they've done something wrong. The problem with this one particular case, it was a young boy, young girl. I would guess around 5 to 6. You know, the girl was 5, the boy was 6. And the mother and father figure, her boyfriend, live-in boyfriend, had created have since referred to as the Disneyland experience. They didn't go to school. We could go after them for some of these other things, which is what we did. But they created a Disneyland experience, and they were having them have sex with each other and then filming it and then making money off those films. And so without having the films, without having the victims talk about it, which they are living in this gratifying world. They perform, like, to your point, you know, they don't want to leave this home. This is home. This is all they know. And for us to come in as the government, you know, we're here to help you. We're going to rip you from your family. You know, you need to tell us, you know, and putting that guilt on them. How are we not re-victimizing them? It took a lot of work, sadly, and it took a lot of surveillance, and it took a lot of things to finally get them to a point where we could bring them in and able to talk with them. And it was a very problematic case. But these cases, I think it just goes to the insidious nature of these predators. It can be the mother. You know, we always kind of think of the stepfather, and many times it is, or the brother, you know, at that weird age where they're finding their sexuality, but unfortunately they're also at the age where they want to go on Grand Theft Auto, so they're using violence and sex. But a lot of times it's somebody that you just don't expect, and we always talk about see something, say something, mm-hmm. as it relates to terrorism. The same thing is true with any type of sex crime. If you see something, it just seems wrong. You need to say something, because a lot of people don't realize that when you report to whatever organization is in your state, you know, with CPS in Arizona, where it used to be CPS, you have an anonymity. You can speak to these people anonymously. You don't have to call 911 and report to the police, because then you are going to be on record. But you can contact these folks who, that's their forte. They're the expert. They're the Dr. Lisas of the world that know what they're talking about, and they can help, and they will bring in the police. Trust us. They bring us in. It's a multiple disciplinary approach to these investigations. And maybe we could talk a little bit about that in terms of, you know, as a cop, I come in, I truly care. Judicially, we're able to almost be an advocate in some ways. We're able to hand them a teddy bear so we can talk about body parts. We can talk about good touch, bad touch. You know, we can do things that you couldn't do in any other type of criminal investigation. But when we bring in counselors and we bring in doctors medically as well as counseling, it really does help empower the child to go from being victimization, a victim, if you will, to empowering them to understand otherwise there is a, you know, I don't want to go as strong as a friend of mine, Kirk Nermy, one time said, where, you know, every child is a future, you know, the only reason adults offend is because they were children that were offended. And that's just not true, in my opinion. But it is true in a sense. I've seen kids at early ages of having been a victim. They're taken out of that home. They're put in some type of group home, and they victimize.
I think, well, that's a really good point. I think that you have to think about what victims are. I think that when you have law enforcement come in and you come in and you're like, oh, I'm stopping this, right? You get called by CPS, I'm going to come in, and there's this kind of white knight position that you're in, that you're like, I'm going to save this person, this kid, or this person, whoever's being victimized. But the truth is, like, you don't know what you get when you pick them up. Like, they don't necessarily feel rescued. And that's what you're speaking to. In fact, I look at trauma as kind of a layered cake. You know, you have to really look at when you're intervening, it might be the top layer, but there's these other two layers that you kind of have to go into and understand.
Not in my skill set.
Right. Well, and it takes time. You can't, you know, you can't unwind a trauma in a conversation. I have people come into my office all the time, and they'll bring something up, and it'll be always, well, I shouldn't say always, a lot of times it will be that it'll be the last like 5 or 10 minutes of our session. And like, oh, by the way, like I was, you
oh,
know,
by the way.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's classic about, I really only need or can talk about this for 5 minutes, and I'm just going to put it on your radar, and then we can come back and talk about it. Because trauma really can only be unpacked about 5 to 7 minutes at a time. You can't really talk about it directly over and over again with somebody who's been victimized, because it's too emotionally fragile for them, and they have to catch up to where you are. And so you have to really kind of build in those pieces, and it takes a long time to get through all of that. You can't just come in and say, here's a teddy bear, we're going to talk about it. If you did that for an extended amount of time, that child's going to shut down. They're going to just start giving you information that probably isn't always valid, because it's too much for them. It's too painful for them. It's hard for them to do. So we've learned a lot over the years, like as we're doing trauma work and we're going through these things. And I think it's really important to understand that although we are rescuing them from the outside, they still need to catch up and understand what that means for themselves. Right.
Yeah, and that's that multiple disciplinary approach in terms of all these disciplines that lend their expertise to bear. Not just the detectives who want to, you know, get the evidence to prove the case against the predator, to put him in prison, and their minds thinking they just made this child's life safe in terms, in a way you have, but the job's not done in terms of the counseling, the medical, the family, you know, reunification. There's so much to it. I hate to spend gears because we could talk about so many different things, but I do want to talk to you about social media.
Thank you for bringing that up. I was going to go there.
See, great minds think alike.
Yeah.
And because we have the expert here.
Yes, we do.
Duh. Ashton Kutcher. And the reason I'm bringing him up is because, again, people think in bubbles, and good information is good information. And he came out recently and talked about how his two children are not on social media. He's not, you know, he believes privacy is an individual decision that makes, and I'm not going to make this decision for them and put them all and plaster them because everyone cares. He's a big star, blah, blah, blah. So he's made this choice, and he's also kind of doubled down on it, and he's talked about social media is a very dangerous animal to the point where he thinks it's going to, there'll be like a paradigm shift where all of a sudden it's going to change drastically. And I don't know if that's true or not. But what I do believe, based on what I've seen, is that a lot of parents are putting their children, like recently with school, are putting their children instead of putting them in front of the TV set to watch, you know, Lassie, like in the 50s.
Oh, it's dating you.
Thank you. They are now putting their children in front of the monitor. And bad things, you know, you can't Google the Spice Girls group and get just the Spice Girls group from the 80s. You're going to get, you know, all sorts of spice. What are we looking at in terms of, you know, Ash? And the reason I bring up Ash Kutcher, because he's also very strong in BLM. He's on the left. He's part of Hollywood. But we got to burst that bubble again and not just think people in Hollywood are all wrong. You know, I think Ashton Kutcher is making some really good points here.
You know, Ashton's been a part of the Thorn organization. He's like one of the the founding people that came out as a celebrity. And I think that that's a really good point. I think people aren't, you know, if you don't agree with all their politics or all of the things that they're saying, they're not all good or all bad. We all do things that are good for society. We speak out on things, and he's speaking out as a parent, and that's from his heart, and he's being a dad, and
thank
he's
you.
Choosing a lifestyle and understanding the realities that happen online. He's probably no like he's not aware of the things that are not, or he is aware of the things that are happening, right? There's no, he's not a stranger to that because of the work that he does. But I think that you do have to look at the fact that social media is, it's a gateway, right? And it's a gateway for anybody to attach to your kids. And you were talking about my other TED Talk. I did one recently called Self-Worth, about self-worth and online. And it's how do you, I think it's like, I can't remember the title, something about how do you do something about self-worth or how do you value your self-worth? You'll have to look at that, put it on the link.
What's the worth of self-worth?
Yeah, but it really is like social media, looking at it, we have 4.2 billion people online every day. Wow. And as a parent, if you're not going to drop off your kid at a stranger's house, if you're not going to take them to, you know, the Sun Stadium by themselves and drop them off because there's 30,000 people there, if you're not going to take them to a mall because you're worried about a stranger talking to them, why are you handing them a device that allows them to attach to 4 billion people on a daily basis? When we know there's over 2 million predators online every day looking for our kids, it is insane to me. And the fact that we have this normalization that's occurring, I think that I was telling Robin earlier, I was vetted by a group that has CIA operatives working in it, and they're like really clean, you know, like I haven't really posted anything or whatever. And I thought the only rant I've done is against Zuckerberg, because that guy can shut down a country, but he can't shut down child exploitation. It's ridiculous to me, right? That's a choice.
So well said.
It's about money, and it's about the fact that our children are creating commodities in data and accessing it. The amount of child pornography exploitation that's on Instagram, on TikTok, on all of these platforms, it is a dollar game. And all of these people, when I see Zuckerberg on some like hoverboard that's 10 grand and he's carrying an American flag, you know, like I want to put it up and use it as my shooting.
I actually do.
Okay.
You know, it's like shove it up his ass.
Nice target. It's a nice target.
Yeah. I mean, he definitely is somebody who has the power to change this, and he's not. And so you have to ask yourself, like, why? Why are we allowing this to continue? Why are we handing these devices to our kids? And if we can get Ashton a louder megaphone, if we can get those people to come on board, if we can put the politics aside and we can put every difference aside except for we bring children to the top and we make that our platform, to me, I think that that would fundamentally change our world. But we really have to look at, like, Congress is putting, like, I think last year they had 2,800 bills on child exploitation that were proffered in front of it. It's about them feeling good about putting legislation up. Nobody's voting for it. It doesn't even make the floor. So what are we wasting our time? Why are we trusting these people if they're not going to pass a bill? You know what I say? Lock them all up, put their children, put their grandchildren up on the screen. Let's look at their history and let's find out whether or not you're going to pass some legislation. I don't care what side you're on.
Got to personally affect you before you make a difference.
Yes, you do.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you talk about how this is a problem. Just today, literally the headline this morning was 40 Phoenix area child sex crime suspects arrested from internet-related crimes. And that is a incredible specialty. I didn't do that. You know, I don't even know how to turn a computer on. And these experts go in and they pretend they're, you know, a minor of some sort, usually under the age of 14, because that's a benchmark in terms of how much time they're going to get in terms of sentencing. And in Arizona, the laws are pretty good in terms of comparative with other states. You know, each thing they do is a separate count, 20-year you know, minimum on the child exploiting material, the pornography, the so forth. But the Tempe Police Department partnered with Phoenix, Mesa, Scottsdale, Homeland Investigations, FBI, Attorney General, and they were part of this operation Behind the Mask. And the undercover operation targeted the demand for child sex crimes and human trafficking. The investigation had undercover detectives placing ads on websites to the whole idiot. I won't even say his name. And like you said, the most powerful man in the world. Mm-hmm. And these are sites that are frequently, so if we, the cops, who, like myself, who's not an expert in you know, oh gosh, all that jargon you talk about in terms of computers and the algorithms is the word I was trying to come up with. If these brilliant minds that have the truly their finger to press the button to change things, if these cops can know where these sites are and can infiltrate them, because supply and demand, and within just a short amount of time, 40 people in a relatively small area of Phoenix were arrested for luring minors. You know, and the charges ranged from luring a minor for exploitation to literally attempting it based on flying in from Denver and so forth. You know, these were people that would have acted on it.
Of course, it's Denver.
You know, here's a good point too that we're not even addressing this side of it, because Lisa was bringing up the point about self-worth. Not only is social media and the internet a place for these crimes to take place, but we also have to deal with the fact that our children are being exposed to social media at such a young age that the rate of suicide in children under 18, yes, you're still a child at 18, whether you claim you're an adult or not, but under 18, there's so many kids that are killing themselves. I mean, I don't even know what the rates change every day on how many children are killing themselves just from the social media bullying. So the whole self-worth issue, I think we need to bring up too before we get too close to the end of the show, because it's not just sex crimes that are taking place, but it's also the objectivity of girls, young girls, and even some boys being attacked for their sexuality. You know, everyone is non-binary now. You have different choices with your sexuality, but everyone's being attacked on social media, and these poor kids are just killing themselves because of it.
You know, you bring up a really good point, because when you hear the word sexual abuse, you immediately think hands-on. And it's not necessarily hands-on. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is not hands-on. A lot of it is, you know, photographing. It's using luring. It's the voyeurism. It's other type of sexual paraphilic traits in these sexual predators that they victimize your children without your children even knowing sometimes. Mm-hmm. Frauderism. There's so many of these bizarre sexual deviancies that these sexual predators have. And so to think in terms of... sometimes you don't know what you don't know. And as leaders in this community and with our different hats, you know, whether it be behind the mic, you know, behind the office and clinical research or having worked these cases, we need to talk more about what defines sexual abuse in terms of the scope. It's huge. In fact, they even talk about the stats. You can't even trust the stats, because not only is a many go unreported, but different crimes mean different things in different cities. Mm-hmm. And the stats, you know, like in Arizona, for example, every single rape by definition is also a kidnapping. So when you look at kidnapping rates in Arizona, they're they're out of the stratosphere compared to some place that doesn't have that automatic conduit that every rape is a kidnapping, you know. So we need to hear more about this topic, and not just once a month when it's, you know, that awareness month.
Right. Yeah, I think that then with the social media, like, and with the crimes that are related to that, exploitation doesn't have to be in person. It can be where you're actually taking videos, taking pictures, things like that. And the interesting thing that I see happening in the last year is that it's not just the predators going out there and grooming and luring our kids and like setting them up and actually doing it. The kids themselves are getting to a place where it's normalized for them to go out and put themselves out there. So if you, I think it's on, but I did a special with Fox 11 and we had all under age 10 kids, and I think it's on my site, but it's definitely shows how kids are going out there and they're saying, I've got some free time, like, dare me. And it's a dirty dare. I can do dirty dares. Please do dirty dares. I'm bored. Like, why aren't you coming up with more dirty dares? And they're going out there and they're becoming so normalized with sexualization that they're offering themselves up in a way that isn't even somebody asking them to do it, which is new to me. So the psychology behind the fact that social media has become so ubiquitous, and so we have all of these people that are coming into our world and telling us as young children, whether mostly females, but like some males, like that who you are sexually is what your value is. And that's where I really felt like defining, how do you define your self-worth is what it's called. But like it's self-worth of like, you're good enough as you are. You don't have to wear the short skirts. You don't have to go out there and take your shirt off. You don't have to do these things. But what you find is these kids that are like really young kids, and they're like, oh my gosh, we've got 30 people. Oh my gosh, we've got 40 people. And in the special that I did, and you know, God love media for giving time. They did a 12-minute special on it and actually showed a lot of the footage, obviously blurring out the kids and that. But they basically came on and you saw these kids with a mom in the background where the kids are like, oh my gosh, we've got 30 followers. And the mom's like, oh my gosh, that's so great. Hope you're not doing anything inappropriate. And they're like, no,
ha, 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 ha.
They are taking off their shirts and they are doing these things. And the mom is not even thinking about what that means, and the fact that we're normalizing following and getting people
like influencers
and influencers, right? You know, and it's, you know, I joke about this, but like years ago, I tried to get verified because somebody told me I should get verified on Twitter, and they're like, you can't be verified. You're not important enough. I was like, I've got a JD. I have a PhD. I've been talking for 10 years publicly. I've got all of these things
going
for me.
But do you have a wet t-shirt?
Yeah, but I don't have followers. And so I can't get verified on this website where they're verifying like fake bot accounts that are sexualizing like these animations for kids. And it's so insane to me that we don't see that happening.
Another thing that I used to talk a lot about, and it seemed that it's kind of died down. Maybe there's a reason for it, but when I was in sex crimes, and again, I'm dating myself, it was, you know, a decade ago, I did a lot of lectures on sexting when it became a new animal, so new that there was no laws prohibiting it in terms of the children. In fact, a lot of times children would find themselves in a felony for taking a picture of herself smiling without her shirt on for her boyfriend, who then would share it with a friend. So they've all committed these major felony crimes, and the laws, in there, at least in Arizona, and I think much of the country, changed so that there's an education component to this. But a lot of them didn't realize. And so I'd go to these lectures, and I would explain to, in school environments. The forum was at the school, you know, in the Catholic gymnasium. I would explain that these photos will end up on the internet, and some sexual predator who you don't know from maybe Denver, let's say, he will use this in a grooming mechanism to show little Jenny, who he does know, that this is okay. See how she's smiling? She gave me this. Of course, this girl isn't, you know, whoever he's, but they use this as a device. And this, and in terms of suicides, what you brought up, Robin, a lot of times the sexting will end up backfiring on these poor young ladies. I'd say ladies, but boys do it too. But generally, it's the young girls who are coerced, threatened, blackmailed, whatever words you want to use, to keep showing these things, keep doubling down, make it better and better and better. Or I'm going to tell your mom. I'm going to tell the teachers. I'm going to send it out. I'm going to dox you, you know, whatever. And these girls are killing themselves. Mm-hmm. And the race, a real quick story, when I was in Homicide and Night Detectives, I couldn't believe how many kids were killing themselves. I just could not wrap my head around it. And having just lost my son at that time, I had to leave the detail because it was just too many children killing themselves.
One of the recent story that we had, you know, it's the second leading cause of death in adolescents, and it pops up and down, like you said, up to first to second, depending on the time. But it's been consistently the second leading cause of death in young adolescents. And when you look at why and how, one of the recent cases I had was a high school group, and they were all from different high schools in the Valley. And one of them just said, hey, why don't we all take a bunch of pills and commit suicide together as kind of a suicide pact. And one of them put it out there. And so we had, I think, three kids ended up in the emergency room. Two kids ended up completing the suicide. And it was just like this kind of like, hey, we're bored. Let's do this. So I think it goes back to your point with Ashton Kutcher and like getting the messaging out that social media isn't all about fun and watching videos of people singing and doing these things. There's a ripple effect of these things, and the trauma that occurs from the shame and from the hurt and from the fear and all of those things is really coming out and going into all of these other people. So if I'm an adolescent and I don't have a fully developed frontal lobe, and I'm like just suggesting like my life really sucks, I'm in a really dark place, and I start posting stuff on it, the algorithm itself is going to come in. It's going to tell me how great, you know, these things are. It's going to give me more information on being dark and depressed and all that stuff. And now I start to share that with my friends because the algorithm is going to share that with my friends. And so there's like this basically what happens are these cluster suicides that can occur based on one person's event or one person's exposure. And I think that that's something that the public needs to recognize. It's not if your kid doesn't get it, you know, if they're not the one that's exposed, but if their best friend is, and they're the ones that are like influencing your kid, there's a high majority and chance that they're going to start to get influenced by some of these feelings, suicidal ideations and things like that. So it really isn't as, you know, as safe and as quote unquote, like fun, just because everybody's doing it, we should do it. We have to really start to parent. And it's hard. You know, I get it. Like, you don't want to call me as a parent. Like, I've got a family that called me and they're like, I said, you're doing everything wrong. That's me. I'm like, I'm the psychologist that keeps it real. I'm like, you're actually doing everything wrong. Like, literally
you've done
everything
nothing right.
Right. Everything that you've done, like by giving your kids these devices.
It's not me, it's you.
Yeah. And like, you know, like, but I feel like if somebody's calling me, it's expensive A to have my time and expensive for them to see me and to use their time. And their kids need to be safe. So let me tell you how you do this. Like, let me tell you how you lock these things down. And let me be the bad guy. I'll come in and tell your kids, no, it's not happening anymore. We're not doing that anymore. So, you know, I think that you sometimes you need somebody to step forward and do. I do this digital detox program. And the parents are like, how do I do that? I'm like, turn your kids over to me. I'll be the bad guy. You're the one who has to live with them. I don't have to see them on a daily basis. So.
You've made a great joke on Badge Boys about your own kids saying, you know.
Happy, healthy, and safe. That's my only, yeah.
I'm not your friend.
I am not your friend. I'm your parent.
That's your responsibility as a parent.
If there was one big advice, you know, that one, you know, there's of course no magic bullet to solve this problem. But if there's one main advice that you find yourself repeatedly having to share and you know, that aha moment in these parents, like, oh my God, I didn't think about it. Is there one bit of advice that you would give to parents as it relates to any of this, whether it's social media, whether it's, you know, red flags?
You know, I say a lot of times, like, don't love them so much that you're blind. Right. So it's kind of that not my kid thing. But I think that a lot of times parents, you know, we absorb our kids' behaviors. You know, of course, like you're driving down the road and you're like, my kid's an honor student. Doesn't mean that you're that smart. No, I'm just, you know, but like,
oh, I have proof, you know, of that.
Yeah,
I am proof,
I've got
of that.
Proof of that. But I mean, it's like we own our children's behaviors and their children's choices. And so what I see happening with this online digital world is parents are seeing their kids fundamentally change. They're not the same kid. Everything's different for them. But what they're doing is they're absorbing that and they're keeping that as the silent secret. And nobody's really talking about it. So I always say, like, don't love them so much that you're blind that they might be that kid that could be presented. So have a conversation where you say, you know, I've heard that this is happening. Are any of your friends exposed to it? Like, have you heard about it? Because when I go into a school, to your point, I'll go in and talk, and I typically separate the girls from the boys, different issues, right? But I'll go in there and I will say, how many of you have either, you know, felt suicidal or feel suicidal ideation, have been exposed online? You know, so I bring up all of these things that our online world is impacting our kids. And about 85 to 90% of the kids will raise their hand.
Wow.
So it is stunning as an adult professional still to me to know that this many of our children are being harmed by it. So don't love them so much that you're blind. That's my takeaway.
I love that.
Wow. You know, guys, I hate to end this because of time constraints. So hopefully one day, Lisa, you will come back and join us because you have so much valuable information to share, not just with parents, but with children as well. Because I had a friend the other day said to me, why are we forgetting what common sense is? We're not really understanding why common sense is missing. And a lot of these situations, it's common sense, but we don't think about it because as children and young adults, we want to belong, and so do the adults. The adults are living in their own technological world and forgetting that they need to pay attention to what their children are doing, and that's our primary job. Am I right?
That is our primary job. That's why we're parents.
Right. Guys, you know, I can't thank you enough for joining me today, and will you come back and do it again, and we'll get into more depth of everything?
I'd love to.
Absolutely. I love it. You guys, thank you.
Thank you.
And as always, guys, thanks for listening. Take care. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Get Real with Robin. Join Robin Cote and her co-hosts, known as The Collective, each week as they delve into subject matters most are afraid to talk about, but really need to hear. Join us next week here on Star Worldwide Networks as we continue to Get Real.